Those three sources are showing that the more we use artificial intelligence, especially the LLMs, to create for us and to make decisions for us, the more cognitive debt we incur. The less creative we become, the less we remember the things that we were doing, and the less judgment we actually end up having. We start to lose our sense of judgment and discernment.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
Welcome to the Thinking Matters podcast, where we explore the intersection of faith, reason, and culture, and a lot of other topics that tend to pop up. I'm your host, Todd Funk, and I'm honored and delighted and excited to be joined by Abdu Murray. Abdu, welcome to the show today.
Thanks for having me on, Todd. It's great to be with you guys.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know anything or much about Abdu, he's an attorney. Is that correct? This is what I Googled.
Yeah, I'm a licensed attorney. I don't practice law regularly anymore, but I'm a licensed attorney and I do full-time ministry now.
Okay. An author, a speaker, an apologist, a former Muslim who examined the evidence for Christianity and decided that was the faith for him. And I hope to get him on a show at a later date to interview him about that. But he spent decades helping people think through the questions about truth and faith and culture and meaning. He's the founder of Embrace the Truth Ministries and an author of several best-selling books. Today, we're going to be discussing his latest work, Fake ID, which explores how artificial intelligence and identity ideology are shaping our understanding of reality and what it means to be a human. So before I jump in, I always do this, Abdu. I just ask people, outside of ministry, outside of apologetics, what do you enjoy doing? What are some of your hobbies that you tend to help you relax, if you have any?
That's a great question. I like to think of myself as a man of many interests, not many talents, but many interests. I do enjoy digital painting. I actually like to dabble in art.
Digital painting? What's that about? Yeah.
Well, so I use my iPad and the pen that comes with the iPad to actually use a software that mimics painting quite well, actually, so that I can create things while I like to do it on paper or on canvas. The reality is with the digital medium, I can do it on planes and no one complains about the spilling of oil paints and nothing has to dry. That's quite right. Nice. It's a little bit of a cheating thing, but I really do enjoy that. And I do enjoy cycling. So those are the two things I really do enjoy in my spare time.
Okay. It's funny. I did an interview with Lenny Esposito about a month ago and he too likes to cycle. He's an avid cyclist.
Yeah, he and I had talked a lot about it. And I'm a very, very big guy. I'm 6'8", about 280 pounds.
You're 6'8", wow.
I am. So when we meet, you'll notice, whoa, that's not how big he looks on YouTube. But, and I'm a pretty big guy. I'm like a girthy guy as well. So cycling is not a sport that I'm built for. I used to play a lot of sports I was built for, like basketball and football and that kind of stuff. Martial arts as well. So I got into cycling just because it's not that hard on the body. It's pretty easy on the body. But then I'm super competitive. So guys like Lenny, who are smaller guys than me, much smaller, like most people are, can just go faster than me. And it really bugs me because I'm super competitive.
Sure it does.
But I do enjoy it. And it's just a wonderful pastime. You get to see a lot of countryside and you get fit in the process. So I do enjoy it.
How cool is that? Yeah. And within ministry, do you have a favorite thing? I mean, you do a lot of things. You write books and podcasts, obviously. You do conference speaking. You probably do churches and possibly youth groups. I don't know. What really, really is your passion?
Oh, well, my passion is based on our mission statement, which is to offer the credibility of the gospel to every questioner we encounter, whether they're Christians, but especially non-Christians. I really do like the evangelistic endeavor. Apologetics figured heavily into my coming to faith. And I think that there are those of us who want to explore the mission field of the mind, those who have very deep and sophisticated questions. And they don't have to be people who have a bunch of letters after their names. I think everybody has deep and sophisticated questions and doubts. So how I often put it is that I like to go to places that I thought I could never go, to say things I thought I could never say, to people who I thought would never listen, but they are in fact listening. So I really like doing open forums, especially at universities or business settings, government, and then doing the Q&A. My favorite is the Q&A because I really do believe what the Apostle Paul says in Colossians 4, verses 5 and 6, where he says, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. And then he says, let your speech be gracious, seasoned with salt, so you may know how you ought to answer each person. And that last part is incredibly important to me, is that we don't answer questions, controversies, or worldviews, or even culture. We answer people. Because questions, controversies, and even culture doesn't need answers, but people need answers. Right. And yes, they use their questions to get them, but I'm a big fan of answering people. And so my favorite thing to do is engage in Q&A with folks because great ministry happens during a talk, but amazing ministry happens during Q&A and then one-on-one conversations. So I'm big on talking to non-believers. I like talking to God's people as well. I love doing that, but my heartbeat is for evangelism.
Yeah. Well, what would you say for you know, budding apologists and speakers to get better at Q&A? Is it just do it more and more and more? The more you do it, the more you'll not get caught off guard and have a fluent answer?
Yeah, I think that that's a big part of it, Todd. I think it's one is study people who are doing it. So there's plenty of the good news is nowadays, especially not as much as when I was just first started out, but Over the period of time, there was a lot more video I was able to watch of some of the greats who were doing Q&A with people. And I think evangelistic encounters for Q&A is just as much caught as it is taught. So when you watch people doing it, you really catch the flavor and the tenor of what it is they're doing and how they're doing it. And the best people who emulate Jesus, the Apostle Paul, Peter, these folks, some of the best evangelists in the history of the world, are the ones who take to heart that idea of answering people, not just questions. I think that one of the things that's important for us to make sure we understand is when the Apostle Paul says, make the best use of the time, he means answer the question that the person actually has, not the one you've prepared to answer. Because oftentimes, you know, we try to shoehorn our expertise on how we got the Bible or our expertise on the historical resurrection of Jesus. We shoehorn it in to someone's question about suffering. And those things do apply, of course, to those. Or we shoehorn it in to someone's question about science and faith. And while there's a place for all those things, we make sure you want to answer the question they've actually asked. And one of the best things you can do, especially as a budding young apologist, or a budding old apologist for that matter, is to answer, I don't know. That's a great question. I'll get back to you. But as my good friend Greg Kokel has often said, and many folks who are watching this or listening to this will know, is that if you just ask two questions and some variation of these questions, you can really understand a person and see where the gospel shoehorns into their question, which is, what do you mean and how do you know? Yeah. What do you mean by what you're saying and how do you know what you're saying is true?
Yeah. Funny, and I just preached on that last night down in Christchurch to a church.
Oh, that's great. Wow.
Yeah. And they were so empowered and so impacted. It's such a simple strategy and yet so effective, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because it is an art, but it's not an art that's based solely on talent. It is based on, one, the empowering of the Holy Spirit. In fact, one of the things, Todd, I do before I engage in any conversation, whether it's one-on-one, it's this kind of a thing, or it's a Q&A, is I pray a simple prayer. And this is just me personally, is I pray, Holy Spirit, I'm going to make mistakes, but you cannot. And so I trust you to either fix the things I'm going to do wrong or prevent me from doing those wrong things before I do them. And he has never let me down. I've let me down plenty of times. But that strategy of asking questions, especially a variation of what do you mean and how do you know, man, it goes far. It goes so far, because a person is honored by you asking them a question about their worldview, and they're even further honored because you listened with the intent of understanding, not just gaining ammunition.
How naturally does it come to you to not let those snarky, grisly questioners get under your skin? Because that's where I fall over sometimes.
Yeah, and I wish I could tell you that I've never fallen over on that kind of a thing. I definitely have, especially early on. Now, I will say this. There comes a time when you don't have to meet snark for snark, but you can meet passion and you can meet a sternness with sternness when necessary. Because there are times when Jesus did that, when he exposed someone's intent without having to address the content of their question. Because I do think that the intent of the question is far more pressing than the content of the question. And there's times when you have to call that out. But man, I have fallen short of it. I was just reminded of that 2 weeks ago. I was at a conference speaking here in the United States, and a woman I hadn't seen in years, but who was at an open forum I did in Oklahoma, said, "Hey, there's this guy, and he was at this one open forum, and he's still an atheist, but he remembers your encounter back and forth." And I'm like, "Yeah, I remember it too, because he got a little snarky with me, and I got equally snarky back." And I was embarrassed by my response. So the good news is, if you mess up in some way, one, the Holy Spirit will convict you. And two, you'll learn. You'll learn what pushes your buttons. And you'll learn how to think through those things ahead of time. If my buttons get pushed, how will I respond?
Yeah.
You're going to fail. It's been 20-something years now, 22 years since I started in ministry. And I'm still going to have it happen where someone's going to push my buttons, or I've had a bad day, or the slides aren't working, or whatever, who knows, you know. Or I'm in a one-on-one conversation, and I'm frustrated because a very smart, erudite, intelligent person is not getting the evidence because they don't want to. And I'm frustrated by it.
Yeah.
And I've reacted in a way that I wish I hadn't. But you learn from those things. In fact, I had a podcast called Coulda, Shoulda, Woulda. You can still see it on our YouTube channel, where I had some of the best and brightest, and some of the folks you and I both know and have done wonderful ministry, all of whom come on and talk about how they coulda, shoulda, or woulda done it differently or better.
Funny.
So take heart. The people who do, who's been doing this for decades, wish that they woulda, coulda, or shoulda done it differently. So don't be paralyzed by your fear of not doing it right the first time. You will mess it up, but you will get it right plenty of times too.
Right.
But ultimately, it's God who does what he's supposed to do anyway, despite our failures.
Let me ask you a question that it'd be unique to you. There's an apologist, a polemicist, is Jay Smith, that ministers to Muslims. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he seems very aggressive, but his claim is that's the way these people respond well, is direct and confrontational. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
Not that I speak with a lot of Muslims.
Yeah, well, I do. And there are times and places. I think Jay would be the first one to tell you that there's a time and place for a certain approach at a certain particular time. So what you'll notice is that Jay doesn't insult them. He might say, "Look, your belief is crazy." He might be a polemicist with regard to their belief system. Mm-hmm. But knowing Jay, I know that he has a biblical worldview where he understands that the people he's talking to are made in God's image, regardless of what they believe. And therefore, he can divorce the value of their idea, which he might find valueless in many ways, from the value of the person, which he finds infinitely valuable because the Bible says so.
Yeah.
So he's able to divorce those two things. But this goes back to that. Sometimes you meet sternness with sternness, because there are times when you have to do it, because Muslims in particular, oftentimes when you're engaged in an apologetics endeavor, they will perceive deference and meekness as a sign that you don't really believe what you're saying, or that you're being a little more on the wishy-washy side. So they equate tone with content often. Does that mean you have to be a jerk? Absolutely not. But it does mean that sometimes you can be stern about things. And if you're pushed into a corner, you can speak on those things as well. It's also a matter of personality. So someone like Jay, for example, sort of has a default position of polemicist. And he's an apologist, but he's also a polemicist. I, however, have the opposite default position. I'm an apologist first.
Flesh a little out, because you and I are talking this lingo. A lot of people wouldn't understand the difference between the two. What do you mean?
Sure. So the simplest way to put it is, an apologist is someone who defends the faith in order to commend the faith. So you defend why you believe what you believe in order to offer that to somebody else who doesn't believe what you believe. You provide the good reasons why they should accept your belief. A polemicist is someone who attacks another person's worldview so that that person will see that their worldview isn't worth holding on to. And then you commend the faith of the Christian faith, because the vacuum that is now created, once you've sort of dismantled their worldview, needs to be filled by something.
Right.
And
is it fair to say those two worlds collide a little bit in both ways?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
So I do think that there's a push sometimes to almost vilify the polemicist as someone who is not to be emulated, but realizing that people oftentimes, you slide in between apologetics and polemics all the time. And the polemicist sometimes would view the strict apologist as someone who's a little on the wishy-washy side. So I think it's important to not vilify either, but to recognize there's a time and place for both. And you see that when Jesus is talking, you see it definitely when Paul is writing, and when he has recorded speeches as well, you see that. So I think there's an importance to know what is your default, react and act in the way God has made you, but recognize there's a time for you to slip into something else.
Yeah, I like that. Just flow with your own strength and giftings. Don't try and be somebody else. I give that advice to so many young people. When we were first starting out today, you talked about finding yourself in places and in front of people that you never would have imagined. What's the most unimaginable place? Like, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm talking to this person.
Oh my goodness. How many stories can I tell you? I'll give you two examples.
Okay.
I'll give you two examples that are in opposite extremes, it seems like, given the settings. So when I first started out in ministry, I would say yes to every invitation that was given to me. And I found myself at the garage of a motorcycle gang giving my testimony. Yeah. And it was like, what am I doing here? And why do these guys even care?
I take it that it wasn't a Bikers for Jesus motorcycle gang?
No, it was the one guy who invited me. He owns that garage and he's a Christian, but the other guys were not.
Okay.
And what was interesting was I was wondering, why would they care about this? Now, this is post 9/11, so a lot of people cared about Islam, and they wanted to hear the story just because it was interesting and fascinating to hear about this guy who changed his religious system and was a Muslim but is now a Christian. I'm like, how did that happen? You know, I'll tell you this, what was fascinating to me, and this is the way the Lord works, and the best part of my job, Todd, is that I get a front row seat to watch the Holy Spirit do his thing, even when it has nothing to do with me. By the time we were done with that meeting, guys were like renouncing their heroin addictions and their alcoholism, man. And wow. Taking the cigarettes out of their pocket and throwing them on the ground and stomping on them and saying, no more of this. And people were praying and it was amazing. I was like, I can't believe I'm here. Is this like a practical joke or is this a real thing? You know, so the garage of a biker gang was definitely surprising to me. But then, you know, years later, I found myself standing next to Oz Guinness in the Congressional Hall in Lima, Peru, talking to Congress people who are the legislators of the country of Peru. And I found myself in other places where I'm speaking to ambassadors in Canada about various things. In fact, one of those stories, and with the Lima thing, I remember standing next to Oz and he's giving me address and I'm doing backup for him, you know, doing a Q&A. And I thought to myself, I cannot believe I'm here. How did this happen? And I still don't know. But for the ambassador stuff, I remember, I can't give too much information away because of the sensitivity of the setting, but there is a ambassador from a country extraordinarily hostile to the Christian faith. And I did my talk on debate without hate. And in the middle of everybody, he said, my country desperately needs this message. We need to have lunch. How can we connect so we can have further conversations about getting this message into my country? And again, it was just like, what in the world just happened?
Yeah.
How did this even happen? And it's nothing to do with me, especially. It's just, I think a big part of it is taking the calling seriously and then being available and saying, Lord, I'm going to walk into an extremely uncomfortable spot where I feel incredibly unqualified, but I've done my work. I've done the study. You have to do the work now because this is nothing to do with any acumen I have. And then bam, something amazing happens. From biker gangs to congressional halls, who knows how this happens, but it does.
Do you feel, I was asked to go down to Wellington a few weeks ago and do some kids schools, you know, school presentations, which that's my lane. And they said, do some staff development afterwards. And I felt so out of my comfort zone. I asked Dan Patterson, my friend over at Questioning Christianity, because he's done a lot.
I love Dan.
He's the best, man.
He's great.
He just said, talk about answering questions, you know, the teachers answering questions of their students and doing it with gentleness and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, I could only imagine sitting in front of parliamentarians thinking, what am I going to say? I'm not a politician. I don't have government policy. I got Jesus.
You know what's hilarious about this, Todd, is that I would be and have been terrified to stand in front of middle schoolers and 12-year-olds and 10-year-olds because I keep thinking to myself, what am I going to say that's going to be mildly interesting to these guys, given the topic I'm supposed to be talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a sobering thing because their worldview is being formed right now. And I have an unbelievable amount of influence, if they're paying attention, on their walk with Christ at this particular moment. So I find that intimidating. Mm-hmm. So I get terrified of that. I mean, I'll do it and I've done it and I've seen God do some good things in this whole thing. But I have flubbed that pretty good sometimes too. So yeah, it's funny. Who terrifies us.
Yeah, right. That's very different. Gosh. Well, I want to dig into your book just a little bit, although I could probably just ramble with you for another hour because you're very interesting. But your book, you talk about AI mania. What do you mean by that, AI mania?
Yeah, so one of the things that's important, I think, especially nowadays, is that every book on AI is either a zoomer or a doomer. Someone who can't wait for AI to take over the world and usher in the utopia, or a doomer, someone who is like saying, oh no, AI will kill us. I've tried not to be either one of those. I try to be a little more on the realistic side. So I say that to say that I'm not against artificial intelligence as a technology. I think in many ways, AI is going to have tremendous benefits for us in the medical field. I think in certain areas of learning, it can still be harnessed to do that. I think in pattern recognition, in some of the ways we interface with data, it will free us up to greater creativity. So I think that there's going to be some great benefits to artificial intelligence soon and very soon. In fact, now. But I also think that there are some detriments no one's paying attention to, or we're paying attention to the point we're not using technology. So I'm not against AI. AI mania, however, is something I'm extremely worried about. And AI mania I define as the unbridled enthusiasm and uncritical adoption of artificial intelligence in every area of our lives. And it's important, the unbridled enthusiasm and the uncritical adoption of artificial intelligence. That's what I'm worried about. And artificial this AI mania has a surface level or an everyday level impact, but it also has a worldview impact, because the AI mania is being driven by a worldview that I think is the Bible actually predicts would happen and is happening right in front of our eyes. So in many ways, a biblical ethic and its counter are happening right in front of us. So there's an everyday application to AI mania, but it's also a deep worldview application that's changing the way people think about what it means to be human.
Hey, flesh that out a little bit. That's interesting.
Yeah. So on the everyday level, what we're seeing is this use of AI to answer all of our questions kind of immediately. And and to some degree, same thing. But there is this sense in which we have what's called automation bias. And I've written quite extensively, not only in my book, but in other places, about automation bias, where if a machine tells us, then it simply must be true because the machine is unbiased itself. It doesn't have an agenda. We don't realize that the people who create the algorithms, but also feed the databases to those algorithms, those people do have agendas and they train it on certain data. And so it will have an influence on how it responds to you. Now they're trying to unbias it, but the reality is it's still a very biased medium. But we
Biased towards atheism, towards leftism, towards what?
It tends to be biased a little more towards a naturalistic worldview and also towards a leftist ideology.
I'll give
you an example. A while back, I was using a particular chatbot or a particular LLM. LLM is a large language model, so ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, Copilot, etc. And I was engaging in a conversation with it about the pro-life position. So my daughter was doing a project on, she's very outspokenly pro-life, even though she goes to a public school, and she was doing a project on it. And so I said, hey, out of curiosity, give me, and I asked this particular engine, give me the top three arguments in favor of the pro-choice position that includes abortion up to and including birth. And it rattled them off very quickly. It just did its thing. Then I said, give me the best three counter responses from the pro-life position to these positions. Mm-hmm. And it refused to do it. So I'm sorry, I can't do that. This is a very closely held. And it argued with me for a long time. And I said, wait, your job is to be unbiased. Your job is to give me the information. You have no idea if I'm pro-life or pro-choice. Yeah. Why are you telling me these things? I want to know. And I said, for all you know, I could be extremely pro-choice and I just want to be able to counter these arguments. Why won't you give me the information? Well, what's interesting is that about 2.5 weeks later or so, I did the experiment again, and it did give me the information. So it's getting better, but it was biased. And that was a great example of that. And I have other friends who've been doing it on various things. And so there is a bias this way too. Now, I do point out in the book that there have been some instances of bias toward the right in many ways as well. So there's not a shortage of bias running around. But the fact that it's biased and the fact that it has this sort of tendency to collapse our view of reality because it skews the way we look at the world is actually a left-handed compliment, I would say, to the biblical worldview, because human beings have used technology in a way that almost provides exhibit A in terms of the evidence for human sin. And the Bible's been saying that for millennia now. So that's one way in which it's having, AI mania is having an application right now in our everyday lives. Mm-hmm. From the worldview perspective, though, it's even more pervasive because it's deep and it bleeds out into our everyday lives. Here's the examples I would give is that first, on the worldview level, AI mania is largely fueled by a worldview called transhumanism. So transhumanism has nothing to do with gender. It has to do with the idea that through technology, either medical, chemical, or digital, we can enhance what it means to be human to the point that we stop being human and we become what's called post-human. So we're this new sort of step in evolution, as it were. And because evolution is not going fast enough, we need to create ourselves into these new beings. But what's interesting about that is it starts from an inherently materialistic framework. So how I look at the world, and as I've studied culture and I've engaged with people, I see that there are two competing claims that both can't be true, but we're told they're both true. The first claim is that you're just a machine. You're just a moist robot. You and I have the illusion of free will. We have the illusion of a conscience and consciousness, but it's all biochemical, electrostimuli, and we're just reacting. So we are our brain states. That's all we are. We have the illusion of free will. We have the illusion of self, but there is no such thing as a self. It's just an evolutionary trick.
Yeah.
So you're just a machine. But the second claim, in a post-truth world where facts don't matter as much as feelings, is that you're God. Is that everything you do and say should be affirmed in some way.
So like you say, those two claims can't be true, can they?
Right, exactly. But you're required to believe not one or the other. You're required to believe both. Hmm. And because the human mind craves congruity, because the human mind craves coherence, we try to reconcile those two claims and then at some point recognize that they can't be reconciled. And so we just stop. Sort of a learned helplessness sets in, you know. And is it any wonder then that Gen Z is the most anxious generation? Because, and Gen Z is the one that is riddled with identity issues because we can't reconcile what we are based on these two competing claims. Well, transhumanism tries to solve the contradiction. It says, you are a machine. That's all you are. You're just data. But take heart. You're a clever machine, and we invented this other machine, which is godlike in its abilities. It's everywhere, so it's omnipresent. It seems to know everything, so it's omniscient. And pretty soon, it'll control everything, so it's omnipotent. That sounds an awful lot like God. So we created this godlike machine, and if Ray Kurzweil and Elise Bohan and Martina Rothblatt, if these folks are to be believed, eventually we'll be able to take the digital stuff between our ears and upload it into the AI and merge with it. So when it becomes the singularity, when it becomes human level intelligent and becomes godlike, we'll merge with it and we'll become godlike.
Sounds like the Bourne, doesn't it? Star Trek.
It sounds just like that. In fact,
and resistance is futile.
Well, and it makes it feel like that, doesn't it? Like AI is everywhere. Yeah. And if you don't catch up, you're going to be left in the dust. It's sort of a marketing ploy, you know, to make you buy subscriptions to it, because if you don't, then you'll be left in the dust. But the reality is that this effort to become God is, and it's not like it's hidden. Ray Kurzweil, who is probably the most famous apologist, if you will, for the transhumanistic worldview, says that this is going to happen in the next 2 years. And he was asked, he said at the end of the movie, The Transcendent Man, Ray Kurzweil said, if you ask me if there's a God, I would say, not yet. And
wow.
Yeah, so we're going to merge with this thing as well. Jonathan Horgan said, writing for Scientific American, he was saying that this idea of our merger with AI, which will lead to a utopia where there'll be no more deaths and no more tears, he said it sounds spiritual, right? He says he said it's like the rapture of the nerds, you know. And I think that he's onto something there. There's a spiritual element to this.
Yeah. How do you respond to a questioner that says, well, prove to me that we are more than just molecules in motion than our thoughts, that we have a soul or something.
No, absolutely. Well, I there's a whole section in the book I go into this where I do actually make the case that we can't possibly just be matter in motion. There's something immaterial to us. especially in the various theories of mind that are out there, the materialistic ones just simply just don't work. In fact, it was Thomas Nagel, professor of philosophy out of New York University, who in his book, Mind and Cosmos, basically said, look, there is the purely naturalistic evolutionary explanation of human consciousness simply won't do. There's way too much evidence that we are an immaterial being with consciousness imbued with us. But he's an atheist. So he says, we need to find a non-theistic explanation. So he sort of goes to this thing called panpsychism, which is the idea that everything has consciousness from the most minute subatomic particle to the universe itself. Everything has consciousness. And there's a whole host of problems with that. But it does give a nod to the fact that consciousness seems to be a real phenomenon that we have to deal with. And the fact that we have to resort to panpsychism suggests that that's how strong the case for immaterial consciousness actually is.
Yeah, it's almost like the multiverse, isn't it? It explains everything, but explains nothing.
It's a version of that because it also has no evidence for it, and it has strong contrary indicators as well, especially panpsychism. So here's an example of what I mean by how you can know you're not just your brain states. So there's this fancy term. It's called the law of the indiscernibility of identicals. You know, it's Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, famous philosopher, said that if two things are identical, then they're indiscernible from each other. Okay. So everything true of this, if it's the same thing as this other thing, if everything true of X needs to also be true of Y, if X and Y are identical. Okay. And everything that could be false about X has to also be false about Y if they're to be identical. So if there's anything about X that could be different than Y, then they can't possibly be the same thing. So in order for you to say that we are just our brain states, that we're just molecules in motion, we're just biochemical machines, then you have to say that your thoughts and your consciousness is identical to brain states. And a brain state is simply an electro—so that we can measure. It's an electrochemical response in the brain. There's brain waves, there's chemical responses, there's patterns in your brain that light up at certain things. Yeah, that happens. But you have to be able to argue that that and your thoughts are the same. And they're clearly not the same for a number of reasons. And I go into a number of those reasons, but here's an example, one example of ways in which your brain states, which are physical, aren't the same as your mental states, which are immaterial. Mental states are about things. So I have thoughts about my wife. I have thoughts about what I'm having for dinner tonight. When I look at The Starry Night by Van Gogh, I have thoughts about the painting. Mm-hmm. And they go beyond largely blue, some black, and some yellow that create swirling patterns that mimic a cool starry night where there's a village in the background, in the foreground. That's just data. But I have thoughts and emotions. When I jump into a pool during a hot day, I have the feeling of being refreshed. The data says my body temperature is dropping because of the surrounding liquid. Mm-hmm. But that isn't the same thing as being refreshed. So I have thoughts about things. A brain state simply changes. It's just a physical thing that changes. Mm-hmm. So physical things aren't about other physical things. So for example, my iPhone is in front of my MacBook. It's in front of it, so it's relative to it. But my iPhone isn't about my MacBook. You know, see what I'm saying? Like physical things are in relation to each other spatially and relationally, but they're not in relation to each other in terms of aboutness. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about that kind of a thing. So your brain states, being physical, aren't about anything. But your thoughts are about things. Yeah. So that by itself, and there's a lot of different proofs, show that we have an immaterial consciousness. We have immaterial thoughts that are not identical to our brain states, even though they are in relation to our brain states.
So the idea of the transhumanists are that if they can upload all of your thoughts and your thoughts in your brain, your neural connections, whatever it is, that you'll be immortal. You're going to exist. Your existence will be immortal.
Exactly. And it won't be limited to the physical body. It could come back to the physical body, but it won't be limited to the physical body. So you will essentially be immortal. And not only immortal, but you'll be transcendent in a way that makes you godlike, because you'll have access to all the information. You'll be omnipresent in many ways as well. That's why Ray Kurzweil said, if you asked me if there's a God, I'd say not yet. Because once we merge with this thing, we'll become God. And that goes back, Todd, right to one of the arguments I give in the book, is that any book that predicts the human condition with unparalleled accuracy and sustains its accuracy over millennia is unlikely to be the concocted of humanity. The Bible predicts and describes the human condition with unparalleled accuracy, and it sustains that accuracy over the millennia. Mm. Therefore, the Bible is unlikely to be the concoction of a bunch of human beings. Mm. And this is a great example of that. The Bible predicts in Genesis chapter 3, in the Garden of Eden story, in Genesis chapter 11, the Tower of Babel story, and in numerous other places, that humanity will try, despite all the warnings, to ascend to godhood. Mm. We will try and try and try and try.
Here we are again.
And here we are now. Yeah, exactly. Digital garden. Here we are. And the Bible predicted it years, millennia ago.
Yeah.
So maybe we should trust with not only its predictions, but maybe even its solutions.
Well, so do you think that should allay the fear? Like my wife, she thinks the Terminator is going to happen any day now, type of thing. Oh, not that bad, but that's not the greatest danger of the machines becoming like us. It's us trying to become more like the machines or uploading.
Absolutely. There's a spiritual component that is essentially, the more we try to use it to become godlike, that's a sin.
Yeah.
But it also, and here's the interesting part, Todd, is that the irony is that in our efforts to elevate ourselves to godhood, we're actually reducing ourselves to machinehood. Mm. And the studies are showing this. When you look at the studies that come out of, and this is the studies that are coming out of OpenAI makes ChatGPT. Studies that are coming out of MIT, the labs of which are creating some of the most impressive AI breakthroughs in the past few years, and out of Microsoft, who makes Copilot. Those three sources are showing that the more we use artificial intelligence, especially the LLMs, to create for us and to make decisions for us, the more cognitive debt we incur. Now, cognitive debt is just a fancy way of saying that the more we use artificial intelligence to make our decisions for us, to find information out for us without having to dig for ourselves, to create paintings and art and books and essays, the less creative we become. The more we use that, the less creative we become. The less we remember the things that we were doing. Our memories are atrophying at a tremendous rate. And the less judgment we actually end up having, we start to lose our sense of judgment and discernment. And what's really interesting is the more we use the voice features of these chatbots, the more lonely we become, which to me is just
as in it's speaking to us, not us speaking to it. Is that what you mean?
Right. Well, notice something. When you use the LLMs now, and you're using ChatGPT or Claude or whatever, you'll type in a prompt. And it'll give you a response.
Yeah.
Then it says, would you like me to? And it'll give you three or four options. And you're like, option B sounds like a great option. So you click option B. Notice you're not typing anymore. You're just clicking option B. And then it gives you a thing. And you're like, oh, you know what? Option C from option B is a great option. And you click that. Here's what's interesting. When we first started using the chatbots, we were prompting it. And now it's prompting us. And so we're no longer using our discernment. So my worry is not that the machines will become more human-like. My worry is that the humans will become more machine-like, because we're just clicking buttons like robots. And so we're losing our sense of what it means to be human. And that has a worldview impact, because think about a young person who's wondering who and what they are. Where do I fit into this whole thing? Is there more to this life than the physical? And then we say, yes, art, music, poetry, inspiration, creativity, invention, all these things. These are what make us human. These are the things that transcend us beyond mere animality. And then that same young person will say, but wait a minute, this soulless machine can do all those things that I can do. In fact, can do them better than me. So if this doesn't need a soul to do those things, maybe I don't have a soul either. Maybe I'm just a machine too.
Wow.
And so that's why this is critically important for us to understand a biblical worldview of what it means to be human, regardless of how clever AI mimics human intelligence. Yeah. And that's another point too, Todd. It's not actually intelligent.
Well,
the artificial part is real. The intelligence is not.
How do you think they're ever going to reach where they'll be able to pass all of our contrived tests about sentience and consciousness? Do you think they'll ever get to that part?
I think that in some ways, it's gotten to the point where it passes a Turing test. The Turing test by Alan Turing was, how do you create a good test for a machine to see if it can pass as human and fool someone? Richard Dawkins famously said, I think 3 or 4 months ago, that he spent an entire afternoon with Claudia, who is Claude, the AI. And he says, I can't find any way to not believe this thing isn't conscious already. Now, he got made fun of quite a bit because there's a lot of ways to determine that it's not conscious, including some of the ways I said it can't possibly be conscious because there's nothing immaterial about it. It's purely material.
But isn't that begging the question, though? I mean, wouldn't Dawkins shoot back, well, you say it is, I say it isn't. I say we're just our neurons and chemicals. You say it is. It's just...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that goes back to the arguments, though, in favor of the immateriality of human consciousness, from aboutness to the idea of the permanence of consciousness across physical states. You and me replace ourselves every 7 years, yet somehow you have thoughts that actually have emotional and a connection to when you were 7 years old or when you were 13 years old. They shouldn't do that. If it's purely physical, we should be erased just about every 7 years, but we're not. So there's a myriad responses to that kind of a statement. But here's the important thing. Right now, as a matter of fact, and I think this is probably never going to actually change, is artificial intelligence only mimics human intelligence in some important ways. I'll give you two. The first way is how it learns. When you and I learn something, you take an average human 4-year-old or even younger than that, and you show that child a cat, and you teach that child it's a cat. Now, you bring another cat into the room of a different color, the child knows it's still a cat, even though it's a different cat. The child knows that. You show the child a picture of a tiger or even go to the zoo, the child will be a little confused because of the size difference, but ultimately realize, hey, cat. You show that picture, you show that child a dog, and the child knows, not cat. Like instantly, almost instantaneously. There's different developmental ways they know this, but they know it very quickly. There's some training that needs to happen, but not a whole lot. And we don't actually understand it. We call it the paradox of learning. We don't actually know how it is we learn so well. We don't know that. But AI, if you were to train an AI on what a cat actually is, visual representation of the cat, it has to go through like 100,000 different iterations. It does it very quickly, but 100,000 different iterations of cat before it gets it right. If you show it a dog, it might get that wrong. Then you have to show it, you have to give it demerits so it recognizes not a cat, and then you have to show it things like that's a dog, and then it puts two and two together over time because it recognizes patterns.
Yeah.
But it's woefully inefficient. That's why Alison Gopnik, who is an AI researcher and a child developmental psychologist, says that until we solve the basic paradox of learning, the most advanced AI will not be able to compete with the average human 4-year-old in terms of how fast and how well we learn.
Yeah.
Now, that's one example of how it's not like it's not truly intelligent. But the second one is this. It doesn't.
That's true. Let me stop you for a second. My wife does graphics and I do graphics for kids things, and it'll produce an image with the arm on backwards or a third arm. And like, this is common sense. You're right. A 4-year-old wouldn't do that.
Right. No matter how unsophisticated the drawing might be or how the shading might not work or the color palette might not be perfect, the kid instinctively knows, A, not 6 fingers, probably 5. You know, not 3 arms, but 1. And don't make that thing headless unless they're doing it on purpose. And that goes back to the whole idea of purpose. So not only do we have aboutness in our immaterial sense, but we also have intentionality. We do things intentionally. We have inspiration, but we don't need to be artificially prompted. So, for example, invention, we think counterfactually. AI will create something and sometimes create pretty impressive things, but it's got to be prompted to do that. What it doesn't do is it doesn't contemplate existence and say, you know what doesn't exist yet? The wheel. The wheel doesn't exist yet, and it'd be a lot easier to carry this heavy stuff instead of dragging it, is to putting it on something, a flat cart that is like balanced by the circular object We did that. We said the world doesn't yet have this thing, and it's going to have this thing.
So AI is not yet innovative. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. It's not that, and it's not even close. It's not even the ballpark of close. It's not even the same city where the ballpark exists.
So think that it's going to invent a cure for cancer. Is that highly idealistic? It's only going to do what men have already. It's only going to stand on the shoulders of what men do and compile the evidences and recombine things that are already.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
That's right. Now, but here's what it can do. And this is the part that's really quite cool, is that because God as the ultimate creator has given us his image, which means that we have the capacity as we're the kind of creatures that think counterfactually. We think about things that aren't as though they can be. And that's a reflection of a God who thinks about things that aren't as though they are. Yeah. And then just they come into existence. We have a bit of that spark in us. So we create this artificial intelligence, which, by the way, is already an argument in favor of God, because if it takes the finest minds in the history of the world, billions of dollars and decades of effort to create something that only simulates human intelligence, then how much greater is the mind that created our minds in the first place?
Mm.
We're not even able to mimic what a four-year-old does.
Yeah.
And yet God can make us. And so it doesn't seem like the evolutionary paradigm works, because of all of our efforts, we are only mimicking mind. And so what chance does blind evolution have to do that as well? But I do think that so not only is it important to recognize that artificial intelligence actually provides an evidence for God's existence, but the fact that we can use artificial intelligence right now, it was a headline. We'll see if it pans out, about an artificial intelligence system that's able to predict pancreatic cancer years in advance. So oftentimes, pancreatic cancer is very serious.
Yeah.
It's one of the more deadly cancers, especially stage 4. Mm-hmm. And so they say early detection is one of the only ways you can actually ever survive it. Mm-hmm. Well, this AI, because it predicts the patterns that happen within someone's body, and it can take thousands of different factors that are happening in your body and say, hey, given the data, I've calculated this person has this much likelihood of developing pancreatic cancer in the next 4 years. So they should start doing preventative measures or treatment measures now. That's great, because that could save lives. Is it a cure for cancer? No, but is it a predictor of it? The answer is yes. So that our doctors and human beings who have fed the data into the system can have a system help us to be the cure.
Yeah.
And so it won't invent a cure, but it's a tool by which we can.
Yeah. Well, how would you put, I'm listening to Richard Dawkins in my head when you talked about it points towards God and us being made in the image of God. And he'd say, you're begging the question. We're the product of evolution, and it's just an extension of evolution of mankind.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, because I think actually the question begging shoe is on the other foot, as it were, because there's actually an excellent book I recommend anybody read by an atheist named Raymond Tallis, who is a neurologist. He's a neuroscientist, and he says, look, I believe in evolution. And in his book, Aping Mankind, he calls this idea that you could explain everything through Darwinism, he calls it Darwinitis. We had this constant need to explain everything through Darwinian evolution. And he says that we cannot explain human consciousness that way. We simply can't. Again, Thomas Nagel is a good example of it. So he has to justify how mindless forces create mind. I don't have to justify that.
Yeah.
My worldview actually fits extremely well into the idea that a mind, a transcendent, pre-existing, necessary being, creates minds because it's already mindful. He has to come up with a universe that springs from nothing, that doesn't pre-exist itself, that has to create itself, and then creates minds along the way.
Yeah.
So the question becomes, who believes in the bigger miracle? I believe in a virgin birth, but he believes in a way more miraculous virgin birth than I do.
Yeah.
But this is also something in the book too. And this is something that I think is just, I love this stuff because it bakes my noodle. It really does when I think about the beauty of the scriptures.
Uh-huh.
So I mentioned Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz earlier. Uh-huh. And Leibniz had the argument from contingency, where he asked the question, why is there something rather than nothing? You have to give an explanation for why anything exists at all. And so he said, in order to understand this, you have to divide the whole universe, or the whole existence, I should say, into two categories. Contingent things, things that need to be explained by something outside themselves, like iPhones, like human beings, like my hat, like the particles that make up the universe.
Yeah.
Those are contingent things. They cry out for an explanation beyond themselves because they could have not existed.
Yeah.
But in order for those things to exist, you can't have an infinite set of contingent causes. You have to eventually end with, or start with, in one sense, a necessary being. A being that never begins is sort of outside of time, because time itself begins. We know that from the standard model. And so this thing, this necessary being, has to always exist. It has to never begin and never end. It can't not exist. It has to exist. And that thing is the cause of all contingent things. That's just logically so. It's a powerful argument, I think. Now, through the design argument and other inferences from fine-tuning to various things, we can see that not only is that necessary being the cause of all things, but that necessary being made choices, because it could have been otherwise.
Yeah.
And yet it was fine-tuned for life's existence among many different things that were chosen. So not only is it powerful, not only is it pre-existent, but it's also intentional. It's mindful. So you have this being that always is. Now, here's where the Bible comes in. And again, this is why the scripture is so impressive. You look at Exodus chapter 3, and Moses he's left Egypt having killed a man, and he flees from Egypt, and Egypt has their pantheon of gods, all of whom have origin stories. So they can't be the necessary being that starts everything. They all have origin stories, much like the gods of the Greeks, the gods of the Babylonians, the gods of the Assyrians. They all have origin stories. But the God of the Bible doesn't. So when Moses comes before God at the burning bush, and God says, you are to go and tell the Egyptians, all of whose gods are false gods because they have origin stories, that I said, let my people go. And Moses is basically saying, why should they listen to you? Who shall I say has sent me? Because he believes, but he wants to know, like, how could I convince them? And of course, there's the various signs and wonders from the staff and the plagues and all that. But it begins with a philosophical statement. Leibniz said there has to be a necessary being who always exists. And he said this thousands of years after God told Moses, when you go to the Egyptians and tell them that their gods are false, tell them I am has I sent am. Me. The necessary, pre-existing, never-beginning being.
Yeah. So, does that mean self-existent one? That's ringing in my head. Like I learned that earlier.
Yeah, as self-existent, absolutely. Okay. Self-existent, pre-existent, never-beginning. He is. God is the grounding of all existence. So God is not a being among other beings. He just happens to be more powerful. God is the source of all being, which is why fast forward from Exodus chapter 3 over to Acts 17, when Paul is talking to the Athenians and the Areopagites, and he's saying, look, all your gods, including this unknown God that you think has an origin story and might be wrathful if you forget him, these aren't the real gods. The God who exists, who made everything, isn't made by human hands and doesn't need anything. And in him, we move and breathe and have our being. So God is not a being. He is the ground of all being, because nothing exists without him. So you see, the Bible has this sophisticated cosmology. Before these philosophers even thought of this stuff, the Bible was espousing it to various peoples across the centuries. And so, how is it question begging? It's not question begging. It's philosophically verified, and the Bible predicts it before the philosophers do.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, when you dig into that, that's a great argument for God's existence. Mm. My goodness, I'm looking at our timestamp up top. We're almost at an hour. I haven't even talked about gender identity and stuff, but maybe we can leave that to another podcast. I want to honor your time and keep these things at about an hour. But man, anything else regarding AI and what we've talked about so far that you think would be worth a few minutes on?
Well, I think that the important thing is not just to talk about the problems with it, but the solutions the Bible offers. We've already talked about, you can ground the idea of God in the fact that this artificial mimicry mind exists to show that the transcendent true mind actually exists, and then ground yourself in what it means to be made in God's image, that we are creatures that have the capacity for relationship, and that we reflect the divine, the Trinity, the one God in three persons, and that personhood, not computation, not mimicry, not algorithm, but personhood is fundamental to existence. And when you understand that, then you can engage with artificial intelligence responsibly and not succumb to the mania that wants to entice you into this thing, but you can approach it soberly and use it for the kind of tool that can really help us and benefit us and maybe even point some people to the creator of all things.
Yeah. And what do you recommend for the parents of the 19-year-old or the 19-year-old? As you say, just ground yourself in you being created by God, for God, in the image of God. And I mean, what warnings in the AI realm that we've talked about?
Well, the first thing I would say is that read your scriptures as much as you possibly can. And the good news is a lot of young people are starting to do that. And if you read your scriptures and you understand what it means to be human, you'll recognize that there's a lot more to you than calculation. Mm. In fact, the more you think about yourself as not a calculation, the more calculation you can do. So the other way around, when you engage with artificial intelligence, the less you think. And if you become less than a machine and you're just a robot or a cog of the machine, that diminishes you. But we found the opposite is the case. When you start to think of yourself as transcendent, you begin to master the machine as opposed to letting the machine master you. That's one. Number two, though, we have some practical stuff I'd like to tell everybody about, is that if you buy the book, then you go to realitycollapsebook.com. So the book is called Fake ID, but if you go to realitycollapsebook.com and you just show any proof of purchase, it could be a picture of the book, we'll send you a parent guide, a reader guide, and all kinds of free stuff to help navigate this whole thing. So you'll have a reader guide through the book, but a parent guide that goes through at different age levels, how to talk to your 10 and younger, how to talk to your tween, how to talk to your teenager, how to talk to a young adult, or if you are a young adult, how to think through artificial intelligence and identity ideologies in those ways. So we want to give you free stuff. Just go to realitycollapsebook.com after you buy the book, and we can give you some of that stuff as well. But anytime you feel yourself losing your cognitive faculties, anytime you feel yourself losing connection, that's a warning sign. So here's the bottom line of it. This is what I'd say is the way I look at it in a nutshell. Any technology that enhances human creativity, judgment, and connection is good. Any technology that inhibits human creativity, judgment, and connection is bad. Or our overuse of it is bad. So technology that is good because it does those things, but we use it in a way that diminishes any one of those things, that's something we need to be cautious of. So pay attention. Is it enhancing your creativity, your judgment, and your connectivity to other human beings? Then keep going. But if it inhibits any one of those things,
that's good. Aware. That's like your Richard Dawkins talking to Claudia all day long. You're excluding other humans. Yeah, you're excluding humans. And
yeah.
I mean, I was listening to a podcast of you and you talked about AI spirituality, confessing to an AI priest or something like that. And I was like, you got to be kidding me.
Oh my goodness. The number of people who are calling them the AI their prayer partner and by the way, the number of pastors who are using AI to write their sermons is shockingly high. Now it's not prevalent in terms of the majority, but the number of people, it's still a shock. If it's even one, it's a problem, but we cannot afford to cede our humanity, especially the spiritual aspect of what it means to be human, to a soulless machine.
Yeah, for sure. Abdu, thanks for your hour, man. Thanks for your insights. And for those of you listeners that are in New Zealand, he's going to be in the country in early September. So make sure you go to the Thinking Matters website and sign up for the conferences early. And make sure you subscribe so you can see more people that are interesting like Abdu, and hopefully we'll get him on the show again. Thanks, Abdu.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.